Football is around the corner, and we are ramping it up over here on the Ringer NFL feed in the month of August.
Every week, Ben Solak and I will be bringing you not one, but two extra point takens. That's right, double the trouble as we predict, debate, and analyze our way through camp and the preseason every Monday and Friday.
But that is not all. Stephen Ruiz and I will be coming to you every Wednesday. We'll talk about everything in the world of the NFL. And who knows, maybe Stephen will even have something nice to say about your favorite squad. Though, frankly, I wouldn't count on it.
Subscribe to the Ringer NFL show on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
And be sure to follow the Ringer NFL on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter at Ringer NFL.
This episode is brought to you by Jiffy Lube. Cars can be a big investment, so it's important to take care of them. I once got a car that I started out with 25,000 miles on. I got it to over 200,000 miles because I took care of it. You know how you take care of a car? You take care of the maintenance, the oil, the brakes, all that stuff. And if you don't, you can have a car just completely fall apart. When your car needs maintenance, head to Jiffy Lube. They provide automotive excellence at speed. Get your oil changed, brakes checked, tons of other multi-care services. It's all done by expertly trained technicians who actually care about taking care of you and your car. Jiffy Lube, car more. To find coupons and start an instant online estimate, visit JiffyLube.com. This episode is brought to you by Cars.com. When you add your car to your garage on Cars.com, you'll unlock access to real-time insights into how much your car is worth. Plus, view its historical and projected value to decide when to sell. So when the time is right, you can secure an instant offer from a local dealership or sell it yourself on Cars.com. Start tracking your car's value with your garage on cars.com.
And welcome to another episode of the Bakari Sellers Podcast. Today we got a smart guest on us to walk us through some historical events that we need to know about. We're going to focus on one in particular around her amazing work. But we have Lyra Montero on with us. How are you doing today, first and foremost?
I'm doing okay.
Good.
Yeah, okay. I'm glad it's finally starting to be spring in New York City.
Well, there you have it. You know, our paths crossed because I'm working on a case in the 1985 MOVE bombing representing Lionel Dotson, whose siblings and mother were killed in the MOVE bombing, and their remains were trotted around town by the likes of University of Penn and the Penn Museum and the city of Philadelphia. And we were talking to people who were smart on this subject, and we came across this amazing soul. So, Lyra, we start each one of our shows by having our guests walk us through the arc of their career. So can you walk us through each of the stops in your academic career and talk to us about your research interests, which include this really incredible archaeological work that you do?
Sure. Yeah. Well, it's a bit of a long path, career-wise, but just in terms of how I get to the work that I'm doing now, I think I would want to start by saying that I grew up on the West Coast in a small town, a very, very white small town, where I was raised by, you know, parents who very much believed in, you know, 1980s ideas of colorblindness and all of this, and came out to the East Coast for college. I went to NYU starting in 2000, and initially studied anthropology and classics, and because I already, you know, archaeology was definitely a major interest of mine from very early on, I eventually ended up also going to the University of Michigan for graduate work, and then following my PhD advisor to Brown University, and that's where I wrote my PhD about ideas about the ancient Mediterranean, specifically Greece, Rome, and Egypt, and how they were figured as ancestral cultures for both white and Black Americans in the early United States. And that's how I first encountered Samuel George Morton, who is one of the racial scientists who features heavily in the article that you're talking about, and really brought and whose collection of skulls that he collected, that he stole really from around the world, over 1,000 of them are currently housed at the Penn Museum, which is the museum of the University of Pennsylvania, which is, despite its name, an Ivy League university.
Mm. So I want to talk at length about your work around the MOVE bombing and the remains of Black Philadelphians involved in that tragedy. For background, and we're going to start here because you're somebody who can talk eloquently about it from your scholarly perch, but explain to listeners what the MOVE bombing was and the players involved in handling the remains of Black Philadelphians involved in the MOVE bombing.
Sure. Yeah. So the MOVE bombing was a really horrifying incident that reveals, you know, the ongoing nature of white supremacy and its power in the United States. In 1985, the city of Philadelphia decided to bomb the house of a group called the Black Liberation Group called MOVE in West Philadelphia. And in so doing, they murdered 11 people. And 5 of those people were children. Not that obviously it's okay to murder the adults either, right? They murdered 11 people. 2 people did survive and managed to escape. And it was a really, really absolutely, absolutely horrifying incident, which unfortunately outside of Philadelphia isn't really well known.
Yes.
But it's a huge scar in the city of Philadelphia. It's something that, you know, anyone who was alive then remembers that day very distinctly, particularly obviously other Black people in West Philadelphia, you know, who knew their neighbors were being bombed.
They took a state helicopter and dropped a literal bomb on them.
Yeah.
In the middle of downtown, or one of the, in the city limits of Philadelphia.
Very much within the city limits. Yeah, it's not quite in downtown, but it wouldn't call it a suburb either, right? It's definitely within, you know, I think it's just over a mile actually from the University of Pennsylvania itself.
Right.
Because the city had decided that this was not something that, you know, these people rather were not people who they regarded as humans and who they really wanted to destroy, there was never really any attempt on the part of the city to do a proper investigation of what had happened, right? I mean, why would they? Why would they investigate themselves properly? And right from the beginning, the site was not treated appropriately, as it would need to be forensically, in order to identify, you know, what happened, right? How exactly did the bombing and the burning and all of this lead to the deaths of 11 humans? And also, you know, exactly how did they die? Did they all die in the fire? Did some of them die from the, you know, tens of thousands of rounds that were shot at the house before the fire, right? Those kinds of questions. And so instead of recovering the bodies in a way in which that could be determined, the medical examiner's office and also the people in charge from the city on that site decided to just let them be mangled, essentially. So what was actually recovered in terms of people's remains was in some cases very, very fragmentary. And that's especially the case for one of your client's sister's remains. Patricia Dotson, they only recovered or managed to identify as recovered really a very, very small portion of her body. And so all of these remains were then taken to the medical examiner's office, to the morgue, to study them. Right from the beginning, again, there was a lack of actual interest in doing this right, but there was also a lack of qualifications of people to handle something on this scale. And the medical examiner who was in charge of this brought in to help with the identifications a professor at the University of Pennsylvania, who was also a curator at the museum, named Alan Mann. And Alan Mann's specialty is, he's a paleontologist. He studies extremely fragmentary parts of people who are, or of people who are, of, you know, from before Homo sapiens, you know, extremely, extremely old. So definitely not a qualified person to be doing this work. But for whatever reason, they brought in him. It wasn't the first time, but they brought in him, and he brought with him 2 students, one of whom turned around and left once he saw what the nature of the work was and that his advisor was not qualified to do it. The other student of his stayed, and that was Janet Mont, who became later, and up until earlier, or just last year, became the curator of that collection at the Penn Museum. They tried to identify the remains of the 11 people. They made a ton of mistakes. But they were just there for a day and a half, basically. That was in May, when the bombing happened of 1985. Then the city was, because of obviously a lot of public pressure and concern, appointed what was supposedly, you know, a commission that would be, that would determine what had actually happened and investigate it properly. And which is referred to informally as the MOVE Commission. And the MOVE Commission decided to hire their own forensic experts, right? Their own pathologists to study these human remains from the bombing. And those experts, who actually were experts, unlike Alan Mann and Janet Monge, were able to correct a lot of the misidentifications and determine that, you know, that a certain set of bones belongs to, for example, Katrisha Dotson, even though Alan Mann and Janet Monge had said that they hadn't, right? But they were certain that they were from a different, that they could be aged to a different, they belong, excuse me, that they belonged to an older person than Katrisha, who was 14 at the time. That should have been the end of it, right? That was the official word from actual experts, the identifications that happened. For reasons that maybe you want to go into, that was not where it ended. And instead, even though, you know, parents were informed that they identified that their children's, and, you know, not just parents, but also other relatives were informed that their relatives' remains had been identified, that the investigation was over, that they could bury them now if they wanted to, right? And that did happen with Katrisha and Zanetta's family in December of 1985. We actually don't know what they actually buried, because Katrisha's bones were not handed over to the family. They were instead shipped around the country to different experts to get different, more opinions, still more opinions on their identification. And ultimately, they were sent back to the Penn Museum, back, or rather to the Penn Museum and back to Alan Mann, with the instruction that he could continue to research them. We know that it wasn't, we know that that happened with Katrisha's remains. We know that that happened with Felicia Africa's remains. And we now have evidence that it probably happened with other remains as well from the bombing.
You wrote an incredible article about this entitled Open Access Violence. I hope everybody reads this, by the way. Open Access Violence, Legacy of White Supremacist Data Making at the Penn Museum, from the Morton Cranial Collection to the MOVE Remains. So, everybody, I need you guys to, first of all, Google this article while you're listening to us right now. Just pause the show and Google the article, pull it up, read it, and then share it with your friends at work, because ain't nobody going to believe what the hell we're talking about. Can you give the highlights of that piece? And can you connect the dots between what you mean by open access and how that intersection of racist scientists, white supremacies, and museums created this awful convergence that gave us this controversy around MOVE that is still with us today, some 40 years later?
Absolutely, yeah. And I do want to say that, like, unlike a lot of academic articles and scholarly articles that are hard for the public to access, and ironically, despite the title, this article is indeed open access. It's open for anyone to read. You don't have to be a member. You don't have to pay for it or anything like that. The article is really looks at the makes the connections between really research that I started doing with my PhD and the situation that is currently happening and ongoing, really, right, involving the Penn Museum and the MOVE remains, as well as the remains of other individuals who they've stolen and kept as part of their collections. In my dissertation, one of the people who I studied, because basically the major, one of the big takeaways from this is that, you know, a lot of people reacted when the news broke and became public information in April 2021, that the Penn Museum had the remains of some of the children who were killed in the MOVE bombing, right? When that happened, a lot of people were just, you know, completely, obviously, shocked, horrified. And also there was a lot of confusion, like, how could this happen, right? And partly that's a, you know, a logistical question, right? Exactly how did it happen that they were given the bones and they were allowed to do this, right? But it's also a moral question, right? And an ethical question, like, how could anyone have done this, Because I should say that in the case of Janet Munn, she ultimately even used some of the remains in a teaching video, an online course that was like a free online course that thousands of people around the world watched. Like, how could anybody do that without the family even knowing that they hadn't actually buried their relatives, right? And the article in some ways kind of seeks to answer that by grounding what happened with the move remains in the history of race, science, the abuse of the bodies of people of color and other marginalized people in Philadelphia specifically.
Mm-hmm.
And in some ways, right, seeks to answer also the question of like how you get to a city, you know, committing that bombing as well in the first place. And to do that, I go back to some research that I started with my PhD into Samuel Burge Morton, who is a scientist and a doctor and an instructor of anatomy in Philadelphia, and who in the 1830s and 1840s created a massive collection of skulls from around the world. And his purpose in collecting these skulls was to prove that, not surprisingly, right, that white people were superior to everybody else, right? Scientifically, you know, biologically, it's affirmed that way by God kind of thing, right? But the other part of that he was trying to prove, which was a little bit different from other scientists involved in the same project of white supremacy in the 19th century, is that he also wanted to prove that there were, of the five races that had kind of been proposed in the late 1700s by a German scientist named Blumenbach, Morton wanted to prove that each of those five races was actually a different species and that they actually came from a separate origin. Yeah. And so that theory is called polygenesis. So if you think about Genesis from the Bible, right? As far as Morton and people like him were concerned, the Bible is only talking about white people in Genesis. And there were other origin moments when God created other races. And therefore, obviously, this is a very specific kind of white supremacist argument against the idea that there can ever be change, right? That people are inherently, the nature of a race is inherently the same throughout time, right? And one of Morton's obsessions with doing that was to try and prove that white people and black people had been exactly the same racially and, you know, had the same racial characteristics of what he saw as racial characteristics of their skulls thousands of years ago as they do today. And he, in order to study that, he studied ancient Egyptian mummies whose heads he dissected as well, and then measured the size of and measured other characteristics of and examined the hair very carefully, and determined, according to him, that all but I think one of the crania that he found were of Caucasians. In other words, that the ancient Egyptians were, in fact, specifically, that they were ancient Greeks, was the specific type of Caucasian that he said they were. Caucasian, by the way, is a word that he used and a word that Blumenbach used. It's not a word I use for white people. I'm just using his terminology.
Mm.
So for him, in one of the lines that he concludes in that particular study of his is that while there were black people in ancient Egypt, their role then as now is as servants and slaves. And that's why they weren't preserved in mummies, because they weren't important enough, according to him. Right, so that's what he saw as being proof of the, you know, millennia-long division between races as separate species. I know that's a lot and super fucked up, but that's really how I.
Thank you for the scientific term for that, because that's exactly what it is.
Yeah, it is. It is. Yeah, and so, so that's what I'd studied for my PhD. And in part that, along with other instances of other kinds of projects that were happening at the same time. I didn't realize, however, when I was writing my dissertation that there still was a collection of, the collection of the skulls was still intact, and then it was at the Penn Museum. And when I found out about that, I was really horrified. I encountered them on display there, actually, in a display that really enforced the idea of Morton's science, right? It was supposedly trying to explain it to people and educate them about what it was while still having like language that says this is wrong. But it did things like line up, you know, five crania from different people from his five races hierarchically from top to bottom on a wall, you know, like it was definitely still pushing his ideology. And that was 2014 when I saw that. And I was really horrified. And however, I didn't know what to do about it. And in terms of getting them off display, in terms of getting them out of the museum, I followed the issue for a while. And in 2019, a resident of West Philadelphia who had attended a symposium at the university, Ali Muhammad, ended up learning about these crania, and specifically learning about the crania of over 50 people who had died in Cuba, who were, according to what was said about them, that they recently arrived from Africa and that they were enslaved there when they died. And they were on display at that time in a classroom.
Let me ask you this question. You've mentioned a lot of names, and one name I want you to tie into this discussion as you're going through is Samuel Morton. Talk about his role in UPenn Move, et cetera.
Morton?
Yeah.
So, so one thing I want to say is that the person who and, you know, so that it's Morton's collection that I've been talking about, right? And it was right. Morton's collection of the 50.
I just want to back up and make, because if you're writing this down at home, you have a lot of different, you have a lot of different names and a lot of different places this goes.
So, I mean, I really see Morton as really kind of being one of the people who establishes a particular kind of racism, particular flavor of racism that exists in Philadelphia, right? And that makes possible the circumstances, both for the Move bombing and also for the treatment and the desecration of the remains of people who were murdered in that bombing. You know, he himself, he dies in 1851, but his legacy very much lives on. And it was definitely, his mantle was very much taken up by, in particular, Janet Mond, who was the student in 1985, who'd been involved in some of the early identifications of the Move remains. But by the time I'm talking about now, in like the in 2019, when they were on display, when the Morton collection was on display in a classroom, she was the one who put them on display there. So she had been obsessed with that collection, with the Morton collection, for the past few decades. She's been the only person really ever who's been in charge of it in the late 20th, early 21st century. And, you know, I think very much internalized and embraced Morton's values.
Mm. So I can talk to you about this all day, and I will, but we usually only keep people about 30 minutes because we want our listeners to be able to listen and ride and on the train to work in the morning and on a school bus. But we may bring you back with Lionel and Dan as we get through in this case kind of ebbs and flows so we can inform the listeners about what's going on. But one of the questions I wanted to know is, what has the University of Penn done? Have they changed their policy? I know Lionel has received some of the remains, but what have they done for the Move family?
In terms of what they've said publicly that they've done, is that the statement that they always make is that they returned the Move remains that they know about to families. And in particular, as far as we can tell, or all that's been documented and shared, is that they did indeed return two of Catricia's bones that were used in that video, that online course video, right? My take on that is that they couldn't deny, really, that those were there and that they needed to be returned. To the best of my knowledge, they continue to deny that they have the remains of anyone else, including at least one other bone from Catricia that they have x-rays of that proved that they had them in the museum in 2018. They took x-rays of them themselves, but they never returned that third bone.
This is a tragedy that's compounded by a tragedy, which is compounded by a tragedy, which shows you what structural and racism looks like. Let's move away from this just a little bit, zoom out a little bit. Your work specifically, I know you have a lot of work around Move, but how common is it for museums to collect and store the remains of Black and Brown people? And are there legal restrictions on them? Like, what's the recourse do the families and descendants have against institutions like Penn and other well-founded or funded institutions? I know we've actually seen even Henrietta Lack and her family go through hell and back because of her DNA, et cetera, being used. So talk about that if you can.
Yeah. So is it common? It's extremely common. In fact, you know, your listeners, no matter where they are, the closest museum to them probably has stolen Black and Brown ancestors in it. in their basement, whether or not they have them on display. It's extremely common. And in terms of recourse in general, there is, I mean, you know, you're the lawyer, so you'd be able to speak to this better than I could, right? In terms of like what a lawsuit can do as opposed to anything else. But like in terms of the actual law, there are no laws really that protect the remains that are in those collections other than the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act, which was passed in 1990. It is a federal law, and it requires, among other things, it requires that museums go through their entire collections and figure out which of the Native American remains that they hold can be affiliated with specific federally recognized Native American tribes and Native Hawaiian organizations, and then offer to return them. Hmm. That's also something that can be initiated, right, by a tribe, but again, only a federally recognized one, which excludes a lot of people. And, you know, that law has been around since 1990. There is no similar law to protect the remains of anybody else in museums. And in terms of museums having these collections and how common it is, it's extremely common for museums to have collections that were, people's ancestral remains that were stolen in the 19th century, right? Like in the 1800s and the early 1900s. That's super common. It's also far more common and also far less documented for museums to have remains from more recent situations, right? Such as
we're not talking about ancient relics from a war in BC times. We're talking about now. Listen, follow your research and your activism, because your research is activism. I want everybody, especially the young people, to realize that you can be a scientist, you can explore these things and still be an activist, and your work can move leaders like the work that you're doing now. How can people follow it, and how can people follow you online?
Sure. So the best way to follow me online is I'm on Twitter at Intersectionist. Or you can just look up my name there. You'll find me there that way too. Also, please check out the website for the work that I am co-convening along with Ali Muhammad, which is www.findingceremony.com. And that always has, you know, the latest in terms of like, you know, solid news articles about what about the work that we're doing, any research that we're sharing publicly, that kind of thing. So those are the best places to follow.
Definitely. Thank you so much for spending some time on the Bukari Sellers podcast. You have been great, Dr. Montero, for everything that we're doing and for Black Philadelphians and for Black people in this business of science, making it cool again. So thank you so much.
You're welcome. Take care.
All right. We'll call you again soon. Have a blessed day.
Thanks, you too.